KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm excited to have on Valentin Dander of the University of Innsbruck in Austria, author of the draft article entitled How to Gain Knowledge When Data is Shared, Open Government Data from a Media Pedagogical Perspective. I met Valentin at a conference at MIT back in May, which was a terrific conference involving communication and sociology and politics and law and so forth. The MIT had this conference called Media in Transition, so they're playing on the acronym twice. And I saw Valentin present this paper, and I thought it would be a perfect topic for Hearsay Culture for a few reasons. The topic, of course, of big data is one that it seems like a lot of people are taking notice of, both in the academic world as well as the as well as the regulatory world over the last couple of years. And this notion of big data is something we're going to talk about, because I'm not sure exactly what it means as much as I've read about it. But I wanted to drill down, and I was glad that I met Valentin and saw his presentation at MIT, because I wanted to drill down on what that means for governments. How does government work with data? What does it mean in terms of the public's understanding of what governments are doing? What does it mean, of course, and I saw this presentation prior to the more recent events involving Edward Snowden and the NSA, but what does it mean in terms of the information that the government has about private individuals and how it can be used? And what can government do to be more transparent, accountable, open, and accessible to the regulated public? And so enter Valentin's article. We are going to be discussing today on Hearsay Culture, through the crucible of Valentin's article, the question of what open government data is, how we use it, what its impact is, where the state of our understanding of government operations and data is. We're also going to talk a bit about some interesting distinctions in Austria involving the open government world, particularly, and I think one that has been a topic on Hearsay Culture, but Austria's slightly different view regarding transparency and what information should be made public, because as we will discuss with Valentin, Austria has a law called the Obligation of Discretion, which is actually very, from what I understand of it, quite different than the presumptions in U.S. freedom of information laws involving presumptions of transparency. So we're going to spend a good amount of time on this topic today and dig deep into this draft with Valentin. By way of a very brief background, Valentin is a PhD candidate and lecturer at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. He is joining us via Skype today, and we are recording on July 15th for airing on July 17th. So, Valentin, thank you much for joining us. It's a bit later where you are than it is here in the United States. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And I should also mention, because as we were chatting, when I met you at MIT and also prior, you're a radio guy too. So an extra thank you and welcome for being here and joining me in this medium.
It's a big pleasure to be here.
You know what? I'm going to do this, which I rarely get to do, but anytime I know someone does radio, before I even ask you to introduce yourself more generally in terms of this topic today, tell us a bit about your radio background, and by that we can get into your background more generally and how you became interested in open government data.
Yeah, it's very different fields, actually. I'm actually working in this free radio station in Innsbruck. It's a kind of non-commercial, paid or financed by subsidiaries from the state, from the county and the city. And it has a strong political intention, actually. So it's it has kind of anti-racistic, anti-sexist, and so on, backgrounds, and is very much trying to cover those parts in the media that are not covered by mainstream media and established media. So I started a few years ago doing a show with two other people. It's a honorary basis that we're doing this on cultural topics, scientific topics sometimes, and of course political ones. And it's great fun. It's Yeah, you really come to meet a lot of great people and talk to them, if, even if they are not somewhere around.
So I'm going to give you the opportunity here because I'm curious too. So can you give us the, for those of us here in the U.S. and elsewhere that want to tune it in, can we stream it? How can we access the station or your work?
Yeah, you can stream it. It's freirad.at, which is freirad.at. Very small radio station, actually. And the funny part about it is many people ask how many people are really listening to your station, but we simply don't know. We have not a single idea. I don't know how it is about your station in Stanford, but we simply don't know it.
We also don't care so much. Yeah, well, I'm about to say so, you know, and I don't want to get now into the weeds of arcane radio stuff too much, but I will say, that, and, you know, and I euphemistically record, in what I jokingly call the, East Coast studios of KZSU, because I record this show in North Carolina where I have my full-time job at Elon University, and then I, share files with, KZSU on the West Coast. So, I'm not as intimately involved in the day-to-day operations of the station, even as I was when I was there as a fellow in the mid-2000s. But I do think there's at least some data out there, you know, based upon who's streaming and so forth. But it is difficult to assess that. One last question about your station before we turn to your academic work. You know, of course, and I appreciate you conducting this interview in English. What language or languages would we hear on your station?
Of course, the language being spoken mostly is German, but we're trying, and this is a big part of the efforts of the station as well, is to cover a wide range of different languages. So at the moment there are shows in Italian, in French, in English, of course. There are some in Kurdic, Turkish, Serbo-Croatic. So several more. It's very much migrant based even, and that makes it much more interesting as well.
Well, I think, you know, I'm so tempted because, you know, my interest in radio is deep enough that I'm thinking, maybe it'd just be fun to spend the rest of the interview talking about radio, but I think I'm going to save that maybe for a follow-up interview and then turn to our focus here. But again, welcome for what you're doing. So let's start the dive here. You know, I introduced you by making reference to big data. And perhaps before we define what big data is, I think that, you know, front and center is the question of what open government data is. So tell us first, I mean, how did you get interested in open government data by way of defining what open government data is for listeners?
Okay. So my master thesis was on a media art project, and it already was at the intersection of media theory, media philosophy, but also a political impact of digital media, kind of. So that's a crossroads that really interests me, first of all. And I was looking for a phenomenon that kind of covers a similar part, but is maybe more up to date. So I stumbled over this open government data thing that started in April last year, also in the Tyrol, which is the county that I'm living in Austria. They opened a portal online, and at least some data sets they collected in the past years. So I thought, okay, wow, that's an interesting thing. No one really asked for it. It was a kind of a Easter surprise, as it was described in some articles online. And I thought, okay, that might change something in the political culture in Tyrol as well as in Austria. So that was the first time I got in touch with this concept at all. And I think it was in 2009 or even a year before, 2008, when a group of, might call them visionaries probably, gathered in the United States, and they were talking about open government data. So they issued a set of principles that might be crucial for government data if governments were willing to release their data online and just for free use. They were very much referring to open standards, so all the data that should get out there, should not be in prioritary formats, for example, as we know it from very established Microsoft products, for example, or several others. This is one very important part. Then it should be machine readable, which is also crucial to this concept. Machine readability means the data are marked by metadata that can be read by programs again. So that makes it much more easy to extract and work with it, to process it and visualize it, for example. And there are several more principles to be timely and accessible, non-discriminatory, and so on. So this is the OGD, Open Government Data part. And I think it is also important to make a distinction between OGD and big data, mm-hmm. which might overlap in some parts, but especially referring to this Tyrolean portal I was talking about before, you couldn't really call that big data. I mean, there is not such a thing as a clear or very distinct definition of big data. It's rather undefined, and I think it has a similar problem as new media. When does new media end being new, and when does big data end being big? That's, I think, the main question or the main problem in calling a thing something like that. But one definition that you might use is Lev Manovic tried to put it on this point, and I think it probably fits. So it's a term applied, and I'm quoting now, to data sets whose size is beyond the ability of commonly used software tools to capture, manage, and process the data within a tolerable elapsed time. Unquote. So, okay, commonly used software, I might add hardware as well. So with my computer, I couldn't process big data, which goes up to petabytes and much larger amounts of data that my computer, for example, just couldn't process at all, probably. And at this point, it forks from the OGD concept if I regard it from a democratic or democratizing point of view that aims at a point where as many people as possible can use OGD, while the definition of big data already implies that not everyone can use it. Mm-hmm. So that's the point where it differs, but it overlaps certainly in some parts. Yeah.
Now, so when we talk about to give us a context, when we talk about open government. Right, I mean, the concept of open government has been around for decades at least. Yeah. Of course, government data has existed since there was government, although we may not have called it as such. So what is new or different about how we think about open government data today? Is it literally our technological ability to assess that data? Is it the amount of it? Is it all those things? Is there a way to crystallize what we mean by open government data today in a way that would have been different, say, 20 years ago prior to the commercial internet?
Yeah, it's a very good question, actually. New terms don't actually imply new phenomena at all.
Right.
I think there are some parts that are new and that are worth dealing with it. First of all, the technological development gives a slight change to dealing with these data. So 20 years ago, not everyone had a computer, and it is a difference processing these data with a computer because you can simply work out more of it. That's maybe the first thing I'd like to say. Then this open compound adds another attitude that is very much linked to this open universe thing. So we have all these catchy terms like open access, like open publishing in scientific or academic fields. We do have open source codes for software. We have open educational resources, for example, so educational material that can be used without copyright problems. And these are important points to clarify this legal situation. I mean, I'm not so much into legal stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that's more your field, but at least I understand so much that this really helps to clarify the situation. What can I use and what is okay to use without any legal problems? So I think there really is a difference between nowadays and 20 years ago. What certainly is misleading at a certain point is that open data automatically generates open government. There is this very interesting article by, I think it's Ewan Robinson, who are trying to frickle these two terms apart. Because, of course, a government could publish a lot of data sets they collected. And still, if there is not some kind of a feedback channel that people could involve with this data and formulate like complaints or demands at the government that will be regarded for their own policy, it's not really an open government, even if they're using open data or open government data. So it's a little misleading to match it all in one term, like this open government data thing. I think it makes sense to see also this part of the game.
So let's dig in a little bit here on what you're focusing on in the paper. Perhaps I'll jump to the classic scholar question, which is the thesis. If you're going to identify a thesis of your draft article, How to Gain Knowledge When Data is Shared, Open Government Data from a Media Pedagogical Perspective, what is it?
Yeah, it's a hard question, and we're not so much trained to answer these questions around here. But I'm at the very beginning of my PhD thesis, so I'm more strolling around within this field, so much at the very beginning. In this paper that I presented at the Media and Transition Aid Conference, the basic hypothesis is just as simple as that. Data are getting more and more important, and it's a very important code in representation of content, culture, whatever. And therefore, it is important for education, and media pedagogy to take this into consideration for their own concepts, which hasn't really happened as far as I can see. And I think this is the lack where I want to step in. But as I said, this is a very, very basic and, as I said, I'm at the beginning of my thesis, so right. For now I'm happy with that.
Yep, and that's fine, because I mean a lot of what I want to do today is really just kind of, set the stage for, what this issue is and what open government data is and even big data, because it's heard so much and I don't think it's well understood. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. We're chatting with Valentin Dander of the University of Innsbruck in Austria. Let me ask you this question, Valentin. I mean, what is this stat? And this is obviously such a broad question, so I'll invite you to narrow it as you think appropriate. What is the status of open government data in democratic countries? And by that I really mean, how embraced would you say it is today, or ingrained into the fabric of government that there should be something as open government data?
I think it's very much growing. As I said before, in 2007 or 8, this concept was launched more or less under this name. And shortly after 2009, U.S. President Barack Obama, shortly after being elected, gave out this open government directive and made a strong comment in pushing this issue, actually. And the same in the UK. So this was in the very beginning, and this is like 4 years ago now. By now, we have strong statements from the European Union, for example. So I'm starting from the top, kind of. And just recently, it was in June 2013, the G8 mm-hmm. even published an open data charter. So it already reached the very top levels of national and international policymakers, kind of. And I haven't really found a list of all countries that launched open data or OGD portals by now, but it must be really long. And it's not only that Western countries are getting involved in this issue. Of course, in Europe and Northern America, it's a very strong field, but the same story is in Southern America, for example. Asian countries, African countries are joining in. And this probably is what makes it interesting. I think the visionaries of OGD and also linked open data, which is connected to this, are very much hoping that as many countries as possible are publishing as many content and data as possible, so that you can draw the connections in between and could be some kind of a benchmarking tool for like grassrootsy. It is indeed growing. On the other hand, my impression of, wow, this is a big thing and this is so exciting and everyone is so excited about it, doesn't really hit the point, I guess. Because in the end, if you mentioned this NSA spying thing before at mm-hmm. the very beginning, mm-hmm. and seeing what other parties in this game are doing meanwhile in terms of collecting data and working out what you can do with it, and not only the NSA or other secret services, also, of course, the big companies that we all know being involved in digital media playing the same game. In comparison to that, I think OGD is really, really not big data. Yeah. At least not at the moment, and probably it will stay like that. I just looked up some info about this new data center in Utah that the NSA is building right now, mm-hmm. and they are giving out some information about it. Amongst it, they say, quote, 1,000 terabytes in a petabyte, 1,000 petabytes in an exabyte, and 1,000 exabytes in a zettabyte. Some of our employees like to refer to them as a lot of bytes, unquote. So this is what they are going to work with, and this is far ahead of this OGD thing. So that's where I have to do some relativization.
Mm-hmm. No, and I'll tell you, I mean, of course, as I mentioned in the introduction, I invited you on the show prior to all of this information becoming public, and so I want to get to it, but before we do, and again, you're listening to KZSU FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. You kind of alluded to it, right? There's very optimistic views of what the impact of open government data is. There's pessimistic views, but I want to ask you this nuts and bolts question. When we hear about all this data being available, being usable, being even accessible, what if anything does the average non-techie voter do with this information? In other words, I think it's clear, or it seems fairly obvious that an expert, if you're or a lobbyist or an advocate, if they had access to a given data set, could, put that data set to use. But is there a role for the average citizen, right, the voter, who has no particular expertise in a given area in OGD? Or is OGD really about getting the right information in a limited number of right hands?
Very good question. Actually, that's a question I'd like to answer, at least in parts, within my research process. What I can do now is only guessing or uttering like my my own opinion about this. Of course, as a media pedagogue or as someone being involved in media education, I'm very interested in what that means for people in the streets. The basic concept in the very beginning is somewhat bifold in this OGD thing. On one hand, the promises going along with OGD are very much participation, transparency, and collaboration. So this is these are the big buzzwords that go along with open government data and open government in general. On the other hand, it is very much thought of as this kind of three-step procedure. So in the beginning, you have the data, and then some professionals or semi-professionals, the techies, would come and do some programming and their wizarding, program applications, for example, and put it into information, kind of. So you could have a visualization, maps, interactive applications, might be in letters as well, just as a written text, make stories of it. And then in the end, everyone who can read or who can read charts or graphics could understand it. But I really think, and I do believe that it is possible, even as a non-techie, to get involved with these data. And I've had this experts interview with Michael Bauer from the School of Data, which is a side project of the Open Knowledge Foundation. And he's doing workshops in this field as well. And also from his experience, he could confirm that it's not only an expert's thing. You don't really have to be into programming that much to do something with the data. Of course, at some point, there's a certain threshold, and for getting over it, you would need to be more of an expert. But even with very simple programs, you could get some information out of data sets. And I think this is the point that makes it interesting for me. So what really are the skills that are needed for people to get involved with it and to use it in a meaningful way and in an effective way in the end? And then the big question, of course, is where should this happen? Mm-hmm. Like the established educational institutions, schools, should there be something like data education? Or is it more a thing for informal educational fields, as the School of Data proposes or practices already? I mean, they are doing it online, and everyone could join in, basically. Thing is, who does it?
We're chatting with Valentin Dander, a PhD candidate at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you keep listening. So yeah, you know, in your paper, which again, I emphasize it several times, but again, bears repeating that you're in a draft mode. Hopefully this conversation is not only beneficial to listeners, but perhaps to you as well. One of the questions you ask in the paper, which I think is a fascinating one, is one that goes to the very assumptions of why we think open government data is a good thing. And the notion is that opening government data or giving access to government data will lead to a more open government. And by open, I think we're generally thinking accountable, transparent, accessible, and so forth. And recognizing, again, that you're in the early stages, what is your operative answer to that question right now? I mean, does open government data necessarily lead to a more open government?
I would cross out the necessarily, mm-hmm. but I believe that it can have a certain effect. Yeah, at least so much. I think this notion of transparency that open data or open government data wants to guarantee In some parts, it can. The main question probably is, or one of the main questions, if governments are only publishing the data they want to publish, it makes it hard to arise or work out questions from these data that probably are not really relevant for the people that could do that or will do that. As long as people cannot ask questions to governments to release a specific kind of data or specific data sets, it makes it hard to be meaningful. And this maybe leads us to this legal framework in Austria you mentioned before.
Yes, if this is a good time to discuss it, go ahead.
The obligation of discretion, right? This is the English term, Amtsverschwiegenheit in German. And it is really on constitutional level. So it says mainly that for a lot of different reasons, administrators can keep back knowledge or information from citizens. And this is a very strong argument if you want to find out something about administrative practices, for example. So at the moment, there is an initiative going on demanding something like a Freedom of Information Act that might be installed after the next elections. It should have been already like 2 weeks ago, but it was postponed. And this changes something, because if you have the right to ask for certain information, and this information then will be, by guarantee, published in a specific form or format, then it really makes sense. This whole concept then does make a lot more sense than if you can just take what you get, which is not as much as I was hoping in the very beginning. I mean, of course, there are always some positive examples, like finding out in which areas in a town, for example, the African-American population is higher than in others, and then seeing that exactly there, the water supply, for example, is much worse, or just connecting the population structures and infrastructures, you can see certain correlations and use it as an argument for infrastructural change, for example, and a certain policy within your community. This is an example that is used, I think, by Tim Berners-Lee in one of his statements on open government data and linked data, especially. But yeah, I think there's a long way to go, actually. And as I said, especially this legal framework is a very important basis for meaningful use of open government data. Yeah.
And so Valentin, and I recognize again, I think the challenge of asking you these questions, the inclination is to have an answer, when you're in the middle of thinking it through, I appreciate the difficulty. And let me ask you this question along those lines. And you just referred to one. I mean, do you have, or are you aware of, any situations recently where the release of data to the public by a government backfired? In other words, did not have the intended result of openness, but in fact had some other kind of detrimental effect. And what I'm thinking of is perhaps examples where the government released a data set which turned out to be used, which is something we referred to earlier, used by a member of the public or others in a way that was unanticipated, or which by virtue of not containing all the data that was advertised by the government led to suspicion. I am postulating here, possible downsides, but I'm curious if, you know, in your research, or you're aware of examples of situations where, the release of data by government led to results that were unexpected or counterproductive.
Being unexpected or counterproductive always is a matter of your perspective.
Sure.
I think just one example that is related to the MIT 8 conference, for example. I think 2 weeks before the conference took place in Boston, we all know this marathon bombing took place. And in the aftermath of this of this bombing and the manhunt that went along in Boston, it was widely discussed on the conference. The police gave out some information about what they are doing and when they were doing it. If you want to call this open government data is another question, but maybe it leads in this direction a little bit. And people were trying to get involved and wanted to help in a way, but there was some collateral damage done, naming wrong names, for example, and blaming non-guilty persons and so on. So this would be one possible form, or also like mapping crime scenes can have is a two-edged sword in a way as well. Or for example, there's also the this notion by Jeffrey Allen Johnson, I think his name is, who is trying to argue that a lot of injustice is inscribed in these data sets that are published, so concerning minorities, for example, or like migrant groups, for example, that they are not really as represented as they probably should be or could be. And this normalization effect, in a way, so if we're thinking about the classic bell-shaped curve that statistical processing of matrices spits out, some people would say this has a kind of normalizing effect because people would always tend to the middle. This is also one of Johnson's arguments, but as well as Jürgen Link, who I'm quoting in the paper. And I think it might hit the point in some parts. Johnson brings this example of the U.S. education system, and that some specific parameters are used within data sets to describe the performance of schools. And of course, this is used to compare different schools. And if schools know how they are measured or how they are being measured, they will try to act exactly along these parameters. So I think these are effects that are not necessarily helpful in developing a better school system, for example, or education system. So maybe this gives a slight idea of a possible answer to your question.
We're chatting with Alan Zindander of the University of Innsbruck in Austria on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. One of the interesting side notes here, and it's something I've thought about a little bit, Alan, in my own work, is whether, and you mentioned it again in your paper, the question of whether, in fact, the use of open government data and to the extent that it's there, the technological intensity of having to analyze the data by virtue of using computers and apps and just having that that access exacerbates the digital divide, exacerbates the gulf between those with access and with privilege and with the ability to interact with government versus those that don't traditionally or currently have that ability. What do you say about that? Is open government data part and parcel with a broader divide between the proverbial haves and have-nots in the technological society?
Possibly, yes. I think if these skills and the digital divide can be seen as a material or as an immaterial one. The material would be just to have the technological equipment and have the computers and internet access, which is a different story than having the skills or the motivation or even the knowledge about open government data at all. And I think this tendency of social injustice, if I may call it like this, is inscribed in all technological development for sure, and especially in this field of digital media. And here the question arises: who is to I don't want to say who's to blame, but
oh no, go ahead. That makes for good radio.
who is to counteract these tendencies? I mean, first question would be the state and the schooling system, especially concerning the skills and the competences to deal with all these technological possibilities. And I'm not only talking about OGD, but digital media in general. So this whole media literacy issue is something that should take place in schools. This is, and this I can say with emphasis, is really my opinion. And, problem with this data thing is, where should it take place? I think this is, especially in Europe, always been a problem of this media literacy discussion or media competence, as it is preferred to be named in Europe or in the German discourse, that there hasn't really been a school subject, for example, or has been installed to teach exactly those competences and the necessary skills to bridge this digital gap in a way. And it always has been like a crossover subject, and that means it doesn't really exist. And the same story it would be about something being called, and I don't really like to refer to this term, but that's a name that has been dropped, data literacy, mm-hmm. Would have the same problem. I mean, where are you going to teach it? In economics? Or in maths, like statistics, or in computer science, informatics? Where would you do it? Political education? Probably. It fits and touches all of these fields. And it's very much a matter of interconnectivity between different subjects or different courses that might be involved. So this is the point where I'm not really sure if it makes sense to establish this this data issue in this kind of form in formal school systems. That's a critical point. But on the other hand, as you've said, this digital divide thing remains an issue and will remain for sure the next years. And the only way I can think of to counteract it is like a governmental intervention.
Ironically.
To say divine intervention.
Yes. Valentin, let me ask you this, and by the way, I should say we're getting to the unfair portion of the show. Unfair because I'm asking you questions now, which you may not feel like you have adequate amount of time to answer thoroughly, although you may have felt that way throughout this entire interview. Let me ask you this question, we both alluded to it earlier, and I think again the timing of this interview is fortuitous because as we're recording this interview on Monday, July 15th, Edward Snowden is apparently still in this transit area in an airport in Moscow, trying to figure out whether he's going to stay in Russia or he's going to be allowed through diplomatic channels or what have you to go to one of the three are now willing to accept him as a political asylee. And so the timing here is nice. Snowden and his and the release of this data, and apparently he's holding more documents that he purports would show the entire structure of how the National Security Agency operates. Of course, all touches aside from the secrecy issue on the more specific activity that Snowden revealed, which is this massive snooping, for lack of a better word, of what many people thought were private communications. What is your view of not what the NSA is doing, but more the impact of someone like Snowden on the movement or efforts to make governments more open and therefore more willing to share data? What do you think the impact is now and might be?
This indeed is a very hard question. I think, from a governmental perspective, it's absolutely rational to say that he is an enemy of the state and that what he did is wrong and has to be punished. I think this rationality is completely plausible and logical. I mean, secret services are doing what? Keeping secrets and gathering secrets of others. That's their job, and that's exactly their function within a governmental system. On the other hand, I think governments have to rely on any kind of whistleblower feedback channels, for example, to fight things like corruption and so on. So it's a very, very difficult ambiguity between these two parts. And I mean, in this case, in this NSA case, it's not about corruption. I know it's about different issues that different parties have different views upon. Some say, okay, it's absolutely natural to observe all online communications, and some say, no, this is a threat against our privacy, for example, or this is an act that counteracts, for example, our national friendship between, I don't know, the USA and Germany, for example. Mm-hmm. I think it's really a different discourse than this OGD thing, because I think all this whistleblower discourse is touching those parts that will never be touched by OGD. Governments will never release every information, every data set they have. This would be naive to believe, and I have stopped to be as naive as that. So I think this whole thing about the public-private distinction that we have been discussing in Cambridge at the MIT 8 conference is certainly a very much changing and shifting field. We've seen that there, from all sides, people are willing to give out much information about themselves, personal information. And I forgot to mention that before, OGD does never include personal information or private information. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, of course, all these surveillance strategies or surveillance strategies, like many surveilling the mighty, for example, or the powerful. So we have a very, very huge variety of different operations pulling at this border of the public-private distinction. And I wouldn't dare to say where this this line is to be drawn right now. Really not.
So let me ask you, Valentin, in the remaining 4 or 5 minutes. We were talking earlier about Austria's laws in this regard, which do, you know, are quite different than here. I don't like asking crystal ball questions. In other words, I'm not going to ask you to predict the future. But I want to talk about now. You know, as you look, you know, as you look across democracies, both in Europe and as well as the United States and others, what do you see as the biggest challenges, aside from any we may have already discussed, to getting our hand or our collective heads around what open government data is? What do you think inside government is the biggest challenge? Is it cultural? Is it technological? But I am going to ask you, I am going to make this a slightly tough question and ask you if you're willing to identify what you consider to be the biggest challenge.
Pooh. I see. I think what is the biggest issue that stays for me or will stay in the upcoming years is making the participatory cultures political again. I mean, we have this discussion about post-democracies and people stay at home instead of going to vote, for example, so the numbers are going down. But we have this shift to more participation and decision-making processes, especially on local municipal levels. And I think this shows in a way that as a maybe some kind of counter movement to globalization, on the other hand, people are somewhat willing to get involved, to participate in the sense of taking a part of what they feel being a part of. And let me be optimistic. I think this can be done. I don't wanna end this show with a pessimistic view.
All right, that's good. So if for no other reason than to end on a happy note, it's definitely possible. Well, let me ask you this, Valentine. For those that want to learn more about your work and follow up on this paper, where can they go? Aside from the radio station, where can they find more about both your work and generally about the kind of stuff that you focus on?
Actually, it would be great if they just contact me per email. I'm not on Facebook. Sorry for that. But valentin.dender@uibk.ac.at. This is my email address, and I'd be glad to get any response from people hearing this show and being interested in this whole OGD field linked to education. And maybe there will be a homepage soon. I can't offer this yet.
Fair enough. Valentin Dander of the University of Innsbruck in Austria, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I appreciate you taking the time. I'll invite you back on the show, and say there's a standing invitation once the paper is done, so then I can ask you more pointed and direct questions.
And I'll answer more pointed.
There you go, exactly. And that way I won't let you off the hook as easily. But I found it. I thank you for joining us today. I think this is again, this topic just is still in even despite everything. I do think the concept of open government data conceptually is still under theorized. And so I look forward to having not only reading your work but having you back on the show.
Totally agreed. Thanks a lot for having me on the show, David.
My pleasure. Happy to mention several guests upcoming on Hearsay Culture, among them Dr. Tim Jordan of King's College London on hacking, Professor Michael Rich, my colleague at Elon on technology and crime, Jason Cross of Duke Law, Ellen Broad, the executive officer of the Australian Digital Alliance, and rounding out this quarter, Professor Phil Napoli of Fordham University on algorithms in media. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, the show is airing at 2 p.m. Pacific Time Wednesdays on KZSU, and you can stream KZSU at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also listen to the show via podcast. You can get the podcast by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can also go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 180-plus previous interviews, as well as the list of upcoming guests. I am, again, recording the show in mid-July. However, beginning in August, I will be starting to book guests for the fall quarter on KZSU, which begins roughly at the end of September. So new shows will air through the beginning of September, and then the show will be in hiatus. So I do welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback, including potential guests for the show, by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.